And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Move the Sticks. DJ Bucky back with you. Buck, how you doing, man?
Man, I'm good. I am good. It was a crazy football weekend. We talked about it a little bit on the podcast yesterday, but man, you just never know. We talk about any given Sunday. I mean, anytime you put two teams in a game, you just don't know. That's the nature of the National Football League. They're good players on both teams, and if you don't bring your A game, you certainly can suffer a loss, and it doesn't matter who you are.
All right, I want to get to a lot of topics today. We're going to talk about Russell Wilson coming back. We've got a discussion on what the Denver Broncos did against the Dallas Cowboys, and can other teams duplicate that? We're going to hit that. The topic of size at the running back position, it's an interesting discussion. We'll get there as well. But I think we got to start with what we saw last night, and that was Pittsburgh Steelers. A little bit of a controversial game, holding on and coming back, I should say, and beating the Chicago Bears. Justin Fields took another step forward, I thought, in that ball game. Let's start, first of all, we'll get to Fields in a second. The taunting stuff, man, where are you at on that?
Look, man, it doesn't bother me. I just think it's weird that the league kind of did a 180 shift. Like last year, it was about the fun league. Let's have fun. Let's do all this stuff. And then this year, it was kind of reel it back in. But DJ, we're 8-9 weeks into the season. The rules are what the rules are, and they've been called like this from the beginning. It is responsibility of the coaches to let the players know how it's going to be officiated, know what the points of emphasis are, and then it's on the players to be able to, like, do it. Now, I'm going to say this about the Cassius Marsh celebration. Whether or not he was taunting the Pittsburgh Steelers,
his former team.
It was like a 2-minute celebration. He did a spinning cutter, karate kick.
I was okay with the karate kick.
He saw his teammates, then he stood in front of his teammates, and then he skipped over to the hash and looked at the Steelers team. And so at some point, I'm like, even if he was on my – I'm like, Cash, you got to get to the sideline so we can get the punt return team on. Like, yeah. It's not this party and celebration. So while it's ticky-tack, in my estimation, like the call, I do understand, like, why it was called, because it was a lot. He did spend a lot of time – putting attention on himself. And so I get it. I dig it. But at that moment, DJ, at that stage of the game, you always have to err on the side of caution. Like, you had a good play. You're good. The team is solid. Man, just don't do anything. Don't do anything to give them a reason to throw a flag.
It's kind of complex for me because I think as much as that you're taught as officials that time of the game, you know, which game it is, that shouldn't matter. The penalty is the penalty.
Common sense.
I like it. Common sense. We're at this point in the game. Let's go. I run over to him and get in his ear and be like, get the crap back to the sideline.
Let's go. Yell at him. Break it up. Let's go. Yeah. Enough. Knock it off. That other stuff. Like that's how you do it.
If that's in the first quarter, throw the flag. I get it. It was dumb on his part to do that. I mean, walk stinking halfway across the field to go jaw at their sideline. So was it taunting? Yeah, I think it was taunting what he did. I like the common sense approach of, man, I can't let this decide the football game. Like, I got to swallow my whistle. The other side of it, though, I said it's kind of layered and complicated. I think with both of us, you're coaching high school football. I've had my sons coming through. My son just graduated. So we see firsthand, and I know people that are listening that have kids or, you know, just played high school football, everything that happens on Sundays is emulated at the high school level. And from a ambassador type thing, if you think of the NFL as kind of the steward of this great game, whatever you allow at that level is finding its way down to the high school level. And I see it a bunch. I've seen it a bunch in high school the last few years with some of the taunting. It's out of control, man. Like, dude, have some respect for your opponent. Have some respect for the game. But that's what they've seen, and so they're emulating it.
They are emulating it. And so, like, the old man coach will get on here, and I'll say, like, here's the thing that bothered me about it, like, from a coaching thing. Like, because you've seen it, like, on Thursday, the coach hat comes on, and I'm like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
So – the thing that bothered me about it, and I will say this is an evolution, because those who have known me from when I was playing in high school and college or whatever, I wasn't always this way. Like, I was very selfish when it came to those things and celebrations. However, in that moment, the part I don't mind the karate kick, and then he's with his teammates.
Yeah.
But he goes from his teammates and kind of breaks away from the group to be like, look at me. After he does his kick and then he celebrates with the team, He then continues on. And so when you're a coach and you're always talking about the team, the team, the team, look, man, we want to have a gang of fun. One of the things that I love that the league does is when the defensive guys go and get an interception or a fumble and they all run to the end together. That's cool. But you notice it's always a unit and a team. That's all. Just do it with your team. Like pro sports are different in high school and college and youth sports and all that other stuff. But still, the novelty of it being a team, you still want to kind of keep that intact. Man, celebrate with your teammates.
Yeah. You and know? I think that's the difference, too. Because I can already hear some people saying that that I speak out of both sides of my mouth because I'm a Padre fan. I love Fernando Tatis and the bat flips and the celebrations. Baseball is a one-on-one sport. There might be nine guys out there. It is one pitcher. It is one hitter, mano a mano. And they're infusing some of that energy into a sport that's kind of been falling off and losing energy, losing young people. So having some fun and a little energy, and some people say, well, that's taunting. I don't necessarily see. I think that's apples and oranges. I think it's a totally different
deal. See, but I run and flip the bat. Like, I talk to my son all the time. I'm like, man, I just wish I could just knock one out and just, like, throw it or whatever. But a lot of times, DJ, when you watch those celebrations in baseball, they're not directed to the other guy. Yeah. The guys always look to the dugout.
Oh, like, yeah, to their own guys.
Right. It's energizing their own dugout. Like, when Correa hits his wrist and he's talking about it's time. Or when you see, was it Bautista years ago in the championship.
That was a giant bat flip, man.
Right. But a lot of times it's directed towards your team. They're not looking at the picture and all that. It's very rare that is I'm showing up the picture. It is more so it's like the internal joke amongst the squad, whatever it is. Like, I mean, so for me, I think that is still more of a team deal than, oh, look at me, look how cool I am or whatever. Like, that's why I didn't mind when the White Sox had the home run chain and all that. That stuff is fun team stuff amongst the team. I think it's different if it's really directed at another player and that kind of stuff. And so I just would wish that Cassius, hey man, just do it with your team. Do it with your team, then go. Get off the field.
By the way, last baseball story, then we'll move on. You remember when Barry Bonds would be playing? I think Barry Bonds was the first one to do this. Mm-hmm. When he was in left field, and his pitcher would give up a bomb and he wouldn't move. Do you remember that? He would sit there and the ball would get hit and he wouldn't turn his head. Like he would just sit there in left field, bam, and it wouldn't even move. So true story, Buck. This is to show you how kids emulate what they see at the pro level. So I'm in Pony League Baseball. So this is like this is junior high, right? 13, 14.
Yeah.
And we got this guy on our team. He's playing left field. Our pitcher gives up what he thinks is a home run. So our left fielder, he's going to be Barry Bonds. He's going to stand there. First of all, it's a jerk move to your own pitcher, right? You're like, geez, you hit it so hard, I'm not even going to move. So he stands there, doesn't even look. And all of a sudden you hear the tink, tink. Like, yeah, it's off the fence, you dummy. So he's got to turn around and sprint to go hit the ball. The guy's running around the bases.
Oh, my gosh. So,
you know how mad that little pitcher was, that little 13, 14-year-old pitcher? Like, really? Really, dude?
Right. So here's the thing with me and the taunting stuff, because it is the evolution of Bucky Brooks. Because I would tell you, DJ, I was the absolute worst. I was the worst in high school. I was the worst in Little League and all those other things. Like, I did it all the wrong way. I've since learned that that's not the way that you should play the game. But my favorite player coming up was Ricky Henderson.
So
that tells you everything that you need to know.
Did you pop the jersey?
That's everything. I was the guy who had four batting gloves, two on and two in my pockets. Like, I am sliding and popping up. I am snaking the baseball in center field, like snatching it out of the air at the last minute. I am Hot Dog City. Like, that is what I believe in. Like, that is what I've always loved. I've always loved that part of it or whatever. And so when you talk about Barry Bonds, I love Barry Bonds when he was with the Pirates. I love when he would just hit the home run and then the slow trot, all of that stuff. And so to me, I get it. But I also would just say to the younger Bucky, like, hey, just find a way to make your way to the team. Just to the team. Just work with the team. Like, it's fun. It's all that other stuff. But just
God, I wish I could meet young team. Bucky. I wish I knew. Oh,
he's such a clown. Like, just such a DJ. Like, you have no idea. Like, just stuff written on my towel in football.
I love it.
Walking into the end zone when you weigh your way, like walk the last five steps into the zone just because. Put the ball down right past the end line. Hit three-pointers in basketball and blow kisses to the – like just all the stuff that
– I'm here. I would have loved all of it at that
time.
All the stuff that I'm like, man, get back. I said last one, and we're going to get to all this football stuff, and this is – I'm having too much fun here. You've got to ask next time you see Klatt, next time you see Joel, you've got to ask him about all of his Ricky Henderson stories because he's got a ton of Ricky Henderson stories because he actually was in the Padres organization when Ricky was there, so he spent some time with him. But the one that I'll – that he, this is not when he was there, but I think Klatt had told this one. I think it's actually made the rounds or whatever about the – have you heard the John Olerud one?
No.
So Ricky never knew anybody's name, right? He didn't, obviously talked in the third person and didn't know any, he just didn't care, right?
He's my favorite.
He was playing, I don't even remember where he was. It was a different, he might have been, I don't know, would Ricky ever play for the Blue Jays maybe at the end or something?
I feel like he played everywhere.
He played for just about everywhere. Anyways, he's late in his career. And Olerud, I think, had the double flap helmet, right?
Yeah, he had, and in the field, he played with the hard hat too.
Yeah. So he had that. So he said it's at like batting practice or one day or whatever. And Ricky signs there, or Olerud just come there. One of them had just gotten there. And so they're taking batting practice and whatever. And Ricky comes over to him. And he's like, hey, what's up, man? How you doing? Good, good. He's like, yeah, I played. He's all, that's like the weird hat thing you got there. He said, I played with a guy that had that hat like that. He's like, yeah, Ricky, I played with you for 2 years. That was me. It's me, John.
That is, remember me?
We played together for two years.
Oh, that is. I mean, that is my guy, DJ. Like, I can't tell you between first it was Reggie Jackson because when Reggie Jackson was playing with the Yankees late, I had to be like 8, 9, 10 years old. So he's hitting bombs and he's sticking his hip out. All of that stuff I love. But then Ricky Henderson, because stealing bases was always like my favorite thing to watch. It was always the thing that I wanted to do and whatever. And so you can tell me anything about Ricky Henderson
today,
popping
I'm
out
the
there.
Greatest of all time. Okay, last one. I'm stealing Klatt's thunder on this, by the way. But the other one was that Klatt was Ricky was on like a rehab assignment and might have been spring training or minor league camp or whatever. So Klatt played with him for a couple of days, and Klatt was hitting behind him in the order. And he said Ricky would Klatt be on the deck circle, Ricky be leading off the inning. So Ricky would walk by him, kind of click his feet on the ground like he always did, and he just walked by Klatt and go two. The next time Klatt was getting ready to come up, he walked by him and go three. And then the next time he'd be like one. And so finally Klatt's like, what is this guy talking about? He's like, so I go to the skipper and I'm like, Ricky walks by me and he's giving me numbers every time. He goes, yeah, that's how many pitches he expects you to take so he can steal second base. He's one of a kind, man.
I love it, right, man. I love how people come to the pod for football.
Looking for all football. We hit him with all that.
So funny.
All right, we'll switch. Justin Fields played baseball once upon a time. There's your transition. What do you think of Fields?
DJ, I think we've said this, and we said this a ton of times. There was never any question about Justin Fields' talent. Like, there was never any question about his talent when we were looking at him throughout the process and all that stuff. He had A-level talent. I think what we got a chance to see is if he is able to kind of put it together, A-level talent with the right scheme and him paying close attention to the mechanics and fundamentals, he has the potential to be a guy who can be a high-level player in this league. Like, the talent is there, the poise is there, the confidence that he plays with. I love the fact that when you look at him and you watch him in the game, he's always very, very even-keeled. Mm-hmm. And I think for a young player who kind of plays the game like he plays, I'm really surprised at how even keeled he is when it comes to an emotional standpoint. He makes big runs. He makes big throws. He just kind of keeps it together. I think what we got a chance to see is, man, the Bears have a guy that they certainly can build around. I hate the scheme that he's playing in. I still don't love how they're utilizing him. But, man, there is a lot of stuff that you can work with And he definitely isn't afraid of the moment, because the way he played against the Steelers, the top defense, what they were throwing at him, I think if anything, if I'm up top in ownership with the Bears, I feel good that, all right, we might have found that guy. Now we need to make sure that we nurture him the right way.
I want to read the last line of my report, and this is what gets me excited about Justin, from what we've seen the last two games. So this is the last thing I said. Overall, I think Fields has a chance to be special, but it's going to take some time for him to speed up his clock in the passing game. And I think we've seen it the last two games. He's starting to play with more urgency. There's starting to be a little bit more pace to what he's doing in the passing game. That's his deal. Once he gets that figured out, the rest of it he's got, man.
He has all of it, DJ. He has the ability to make plays on schedule in the pocket. He certainly is athletic enough to make things happen outside of the pocket, whether as a runner or on scrambles and extending time and making plays down the field, throwing. I think the big game moxie and confidence, I don't think that can be underscored. The fact that he played on a big stage at Ohio State, played in big games, and we saw him play well in some of those big games, particularly in the playoffs, I think he has it. Now it's about the Bears, really, when I say nurtured the right way, like really coaching it the right way and putting those things. The only thing, look, I think they could utilize his movement skills more. I'm not saying utilize him as a runner, but change the launch point of the pocket. Yeah. If you could put some sprint outs, if you can put some half rolls, just some other stuff so he's not just always, hey, he's always going to be at this spot on the grassy knoll. You can go get him. Just move it around. I think there are different ways to utilize his athleticism to make it work. But, no, I mean, I think he's everything that you want in terms of the position, size, athleticism, big playability. He has all this stuff.
The one play call, because I know they've gotten a lot of grief for, you know, kind of the lack of things you just mentioned and not making it as quarterback friendly as it could be. There's one play call in that game that I absolutely loved. I think it was towards the end of the game. And I think it was a short yardage. It was second short or third and short. I think may have been third and short when they hit the slot fade to Allen Robinson. So
big time throw.
It was a big time throw. But what I love about it is you take a quarterback and you put him in an obvious run situation. And that dictates the coverage, which you know when he came up to the line of scrimmage, he knows he's got that. There is nothing for me to do except hit my back foot and give this thing some air and let Allen Robinson go get it. But that's an aggressive mindset of saying, okay, we're going to dictate in this down and distance. We know what they're going to do. Now you know what you're going to do. So there's no post snap decision to be made here. Like this is where the ball is going. Now just make the throw.
Yeah, no, and I think that was a big time play because it did go against all the norms, all the tendencies. Because
I think zone read, you know,
here you go. Hey, look, here we go, athletic quarterback. What we're gonna do is we stick it to belly. He's gonna keep it. A quarterback sneak it, whatever it is. And then they rear back. You're like, oh, they're taking a shot. You know, and they took a few different shots in that game. One where he missed Mooney, or did he miss Godwin down the sideline? He launched a moon ball, and it was just maybe a handful of yards short, but then he comes back and drops that dime into Allen Robinson. And you're like, man, for the first time, they can really utilize all areas of the field. They can stretch it vertically, horizontally. He can stretch it as a runner, as a thrower. There's a lot to like about what he brings to the table. Literally, it's just about what can the Bears do to bring all of that out? Because now my challenge, if I'm ownership, hey coach, how are we going to take this to the next level? Yeah. How are we going to take him from good to great in the next few years? What do you have in the bag to allow him to become a guy that realizes all of his potential in the league?
Yeah, no, I'm excited to see where this goes with Justin Herbert, but definitely he's heading in the right direction and excited for him and for Bears fans who've been waiting for a guy like this. So it's fun to see him improving, taking those next steps, and we'll see where he goes from there. All right, I want to get to this next topic on the Dallas Cowboys offense and defending them. We're going to do that right after this. All right, Buck, I'll give you the floor here. Vic Fangio and the job he did against the Dallas Cowboys, what you saw, what you've read, what you've heard, and if it can be duplicated.
Hey, DJ, you know how this league is. This league is a copycat league. I mean, I feel like every league is that. Once teams see that you lose, they go right to the tape and they try and figure out, well, what did they do to slow this down? Cowboys had number one offense in football, having a lot of success. They're putting 40 points up on everybody. What did the Broncos do to slow it down? So I decided, let's take a look at the tape. And DJ, I was actually surprised at what I saw. It wasn't anything that was complex. I can't even say that it was very creative. The Denver Broncos used a four-man rush. They used man coverage with a tactic that we call man match, which means that you're matched up man-to-man, but on crossing routes, you pass those things off to other defenders and you free up. And what it does is it gives you the best of both worlds as a defensive call because, A, I got tight coverage on everything vertical down the field, outbreaking, but on those trouble routes that most teams have in man-to-man, I'm switching them off so my guys don't get picked. Mm-hmm. So now if we do it right, we eliminate the scary part of being in man-to-man. And they did it, man, and they did it flawlessly. And what I saw was the team that we talked about being perfectly constructed to make a playoff run, because one of the reasons teams lauded, we observers lauded the Denver Broncos is because they had pass rushers and they had corners. Now, none of the pass rushers that we thought were going to be there are playing, Bradley Chubb and Von Miller, but their commitment to getting cornerbacks and a ton of them, Passer 10 and all those other guys, they now can lock up and play man-to-man with the best, and Justin Simmons played a role. And because you can play man-to-man, DJ, it opens up a new can of worms when you start playing because you have plus one in the running game because in man-to-man, you gain an additional defender when you play man. Yep. And then in the passing game, depending on how you play, you take away all the gimmies and the layups. And when you begin to take away the layups and make people earn their yards, particularly at a time when so many teams are playing soft coverage, changes the clock. And that's what they were able to do. They took away the layups that Dak Prescott and the Cowboys had normally had. They took away the pick plays and they made him have to force tight window throws and they couldn't get it done.
Yeah. It's interesting because like, I think the Chargers did things a little differently against that Cowboys group. The Cowboys ran it really well against the Chargers, but the Chargers held them to 20 points. So one, I think is one of the better defensive performances in terms of points against the Cowboys. Obviously, Brandon Staley comes from that Vic Fangio tree. So I'm always fascinated by that. I don't think people, you know, average fan maybe realizes how much some of these people talk around the league too. Mm-hmm. Now Vic and Brandon probably aren't talking about that because they're in the same division, but you have other coaches
I wonder, if they talk like a little bit, or if Vic is able to look at the tape,
he knows they're speaking. Yeah, he can see how his stuff would work.
Yeah, as Obi-Wan Kenobi, he's looking at me like, ah, Skywalker, like if you had done X, Y, and Z, you had him, you were close, but let me show you how this is done. And if he took parts of the Chargers game plan and say, okay, hey, if they just had done this as opposed to that, maybe this would have been a more effective answer to some of the stuff that the Cowboys did. But yeah, but now, DJ, it's funny because I told you that last week I was looking at a thing on Justin Herbert and how teams appear to slow them down, right? Because the last two games that we've seen the Chargers prior to Philly, we saw the Patriots and the Ravens have a little bit of success just kind of slowing down the offense.
Getting them out of rhythm.
And it was a lot of the same stuff. Hey, we're going to play coverage over pressure. We're going to play some man-to-man. We'll mix in some zone, but we'll do some different things to kind of take away some of those windows. And just like we saw early in the year with everyone playing too shell and too high and those things, I do wonder if down the stretch we're going to see more of these teams playing man-to-man with some matchup principles to make life difficult on quarterbacks because you take away the layups, but you also take away some of the things, the concepts that teams typically go to get away from man coverage.
The thing that I would say, the kind of the difference, so you look at the Chargers the last three games. You talked about the two that they struggled in. Herbert has one of the best games of his career against the Philadelphia Eagles. Both in all three of those games, I should say, a lot of four-man rush, you know, and Patriots even some three-man rush. The difference I would say is they were, you know, they were matching their coverages with their fronts more in those other two games. I think in that Eagles game, you're rushing four, but you're creating some layups that are out there. Easy. So the ball is out. The ball is out quick. And the Chargers did a good job of combination of ball out quick, mix in some screens, move the pocket. So all those different things. So that that rush didn't get there. I think he got hit one time in that game. You go back and watch those other games. They were getting home with those limited rushers because they had matched the coverage. So there's no easy throws. There's nothing worse than is a pass rusher, and you're going, there's no way I can get home. He's got a hitch just waiting for him anytime he wants it. And that's what the Chargers took advantage of this last week.
Yeah, and I think that's big time, because I think you have to be able to do those things. When I think about the Eagles, and you know it, we've talked about some of the struggles that they've had on defense, is because it's not a very aggressive style. And I think I saw somebody tweeted out, maybe Mike Lombardi tweeted out, like,
in the top quarterbacks they play, there's very few incompletions.
It's like 28 incompletions that they played against, like, Pat Mahomes and Herbert.
Derek Carr was like 31 of 34.
Yeah, like, they're just gifting these guys opportunities to go up and down the field, and you just can't do that. Like, it's too hard in this league to let guys hit layup after layup after layup after layup and then say, oh, we're just going to shut them down in the red zone. Well, it's almost like – you remember when we used to play NBA Jam?
Yeah,
NBA Jam. If you hit three shots, you get on fire.
Yeah,
and so then you—that's what they're doing. It's NBA Jam. They're just anywhere, stroking it from, it. Yeah. just yeah. launching it. And so it's one of those things with these high quarterbacks, and so they have to figure out a way to change it. But I do think it's a good observation. Obviously, you're there every week to see the Chargers, but I will say I continue to come away more impressed with Justin Herbert, because that's kind of like the first, I would say, a little bit of adversity that we've seen from him.
Yeah, first time he's had two bad games in a row.
Yeah, like, hey, okay, the fastball, they're taking away the fastball. Do I have any other things in the repertoire? And then you saw him be like, okay, I'll figure this out. Yeah. And so to me, that's when you begin to separate those great quarterbacks from the others. Because the great ones have multiple ways of being able to dissect you. Oh, I can play dink and dunk. Oh, you want to push down the field? I'll play that game. Oh, you want me to use my legs? And they just have more tools in the toolbox. And I think Justin Herbert shows you all of those tools in the toolbox that makes him very, very effective as a high-end quarterback.
No doubt. All right, quickly, before we get to this running back thing, I want to hit on your expectations with Russ coming back. Russell Wilson's going to be back. By the way, I did laugh a little bit at this, because you know how every other team – there would be reports say Russell Wilson back at practice. He's gonna play this week. No. We're gonna do a press release with quotes from the doctor, who's amazed at this recovery. He's never seen a more dedicated athlete. I'm just like, just stop.
Like, man,
just
he's
stop.
Okay, like here's enough. Like, here's the thing, and I really like Russell, right?
I do too.
I really like, and I've always liked him, even though he went to the rival school in red. I've always liked him. And then he goes to Wisconsin and he has success. Like, I've always liked Russell. I've always loved his thing. And I like the fact that he really bought into Pete's thing. But he has become, I think as the young people say, he's a little extra.
Yeah, right? A little bit.
He's a little extra. Even the video proclaiming his return to health, right?
Where they have him. I didn't even see this.
Oh, my gosh, DJ. You have to look it up.
I haven't seen this yet.
They have a video of him working out. They have a video of him in the doctor's office looking at the x-rays, and they have all this stuff. And then it kind of finishes off like in Lambeau Field, like video of Lambeau Field. And I'm like, the production crew has to follow you all around and document all of this stuff so everyone knows that you're coming back. And I get it, right? And I know we're in this new era because Tom Brady did Tom versus Time. And I get it. It's still different, though. It's still a lot. And so he let us know that he's coming back. And so I'm excited that Russell's coming back for the Seahawks. The Seahawks certainly need him. I'm sure they're going to let him cook when he comes back right away. And then we'll see. I just hate – well, maybe we will get a chance to see him and Aaron Rodgers. It'd be such a great show. Like, two team players doing their deal, you know?
So maybe we need – maybe we're doing it wrong. Maybe we need to embrace this. So last Monday, a week ago, I called in sick for the first time since I've been working at the network.
Yeah, first time. Yeah.
So foolishly, I didn't release any statements.
But you know what you should have done? When you're sitting there and you didn't feel great and you're laying in the bed and you got the covers all the way up to your neck and you're sweating for you should have had it documented. Yeah.
So hey, here's my press release. We talked to, or this would be from the doctor, Daniel Jeremiah's stomach after having some bad Mexican food was in terrible shape. But I have never seen a stomach recover as fast as his did to be able to be on the podcast the following day.
So tough and
after having been up most of the night.
Yeah,
with the resilience. Awful symptoms.
Yeah, the resilience.
But the effort and hydration and recovery to get him back on the podcast was something I've never seen in my medical history.
Right. You have to have the video then accompanying showing you at the refrigerator, like downing Pedialyte and all kinds of stuff, like getting back, you waking up early the next day, like hitting the Peloton, like just letting them know, like the road to recovery, all of that stuff, timestamp. 5:46 a.m. Jeremiah's up.
Bathroom door opens. Yeah, bathroom door closes.
Just getting up, just getting after it. Like all of this, because I guess that's what we do now. We make sure that we can see everybody.
Extra is the word.
Living it out.
A little extra.
Yeah. It's a lot.
All right, we're gonna get to this running back chat right after this. Okay, Buck. So I was talking with a defensive coach, and he brought up an interesting point. He was just talking about, as a defense, the difference between dealing with a smaller back versus a bigger back. Mm-hmm. And his point was, look, when you get into the fourth quarter of a game and your defense, after you've been tackling a 230-pound back over and over again, like get to the point where there's wear. That's different than tackling these 200-pound backs all day long. And even if you were throwing the ball a bunch at the for the first three quarters of the game, as the way that the league is right now, right? You throw to get the lead, you run to finish it. That's kind of the way it is. So having to tackle those guys in the fourth quarter, there's just a different toll on a defense when you're thinking about big backs versus small backs. So I want to hit you with this and get your thoughts, because we had Nabil look this up. Of all the teams that are leading their division, this is their running back room, okay? And we'll look at the size of them. You ready? Mm-hmm. All right, here we go. So Buffalo, Zach Moss, 5'9", 205. Singletary, 5'7", 203. So they don't really have that guy. Ravens, Latavius Murray, 6'3", 230. They've got Freeman at 206. Le'Veon Bell, his weight's all over the place. I think he says he's like 210 now. He's been like 245. He's been 205. Yeah. I don't know. Obviously,
he's like Luther Vandross. Big Luther. Yeah, he's going up.
Oh, man, RIP. I love Luther. All right, the Titans, obviously Derrick Henry's gone. So you got Adrian Peterson is 6'1", 220. The Chargers don't have a big back. They've got Austin Eckler, 5'10", 200. Justin Jackson, 6'2", 200. The Cowboys, Zeke is 228 pounds. Pollard's 209. The Packers, we get to that division. A.J. Dillon at 6'2", 247, complementing Aaron Jones, who's 5'9", 208. So you could definitely – A.J. Dillon can be your four-minute hammer. The Bucks, Fournette, 6'2", 228. That's a big back. Ronald Jones is 208. And the Cardinals, James Conner's have an unbelievable year. It's a great comp there. It's a great fit, I should say, with the Cardinals and their spread offense. So he's 6'1", 233. Chase Edmonds, 5'9", 210. So there are a couple teams, notably, I would say, the Chargers and the Bills, who don't have that bigger back. It's interesting when you look at it.
DJ, it's really interesting. And the reason it's so interesting is because one of the things that we can debate and people will debate, like analysts will talk about running and all those other things, but it doesn't take into consideration like the real life impact that tackling runners has on the defense. And so when the defense coach talks about big backs and the importance or the impression on doing it, it really matters. And talking to Matt Rhule, I was at a thing Matt Rhule was talking about, building a perfect team. And he said, look, when he builds his team, he wants to think about the defense having to tackle running backs, running between the tackles, running downhill between the tackles, having to put your pads on them and deal with them. There is a wearing effect that is on the defense, which is very similar to being in a boxing ring, just dealing with body blows. It is the cumulative effect of just, man, got to tackle this big guy again. Mm-hmm. Hey, y'all got to slow this dude down. Because DJ, yesterday when we did the podcast and we were doing the show and you broke down Nick Chubb and we talked about the goal of the offensive coordinator is to be able to create a run where you get the running back on the safety in space. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we think about, oh, well, yeah, because he can make him miss. No. So he can run him over early.
Big dude. Yeah.
So he can run him over early and set the table for the rest of the stuff. Because it is hard for smaller defensive backs to be able to deal with big backs over and over again. And quick story, I told you, like going back to my playing days, we used to play the Tennessee Titans / Houston Oilers, whichever one you call them. Eddie George was back there. Mm-hmm. And what the Titans would do is they would crack the wide receivers. I mean, they would come down and block the safeties, and they would leave on the corners unblocked. And they're running the stretch play. And so in the first quarter, you're like courageous, and you throw your body in there. Eddie George is 235, 245 pounds. Second quarter, you're not as courageous, but you kind of roll up in there. A third and fourth quarter, he's got a head of steam up. And also, you know, big backs, they get juiced up the more carries they get. So now he's fully lathered up in the fourth quarter. And you're like, hey, I got to – how many times are you going to do it? And you see it because, DJ, you see those big games. Nick Chubb, those guys do not want to tackle. And so, yes, it does matter having those big backs. We've seen A.J. Dillon have success. James Conner leads the league in touchdowns. Some of that is on runs, but a lot of times it's screens in space. Those little guys having to take great angles and make great one-on-one tackles. It makes a difference. And as it gets colder, you're the Green Bay Packers. And one of the reasons why I like when they got A.J. Dillon, when it's negative and it's really cold.
That's a lot to deal with.
And you're sitting there trying to figure out, why am I on this field today? And then you got this dude just coming downhill like a – you don't want to have to deal with it. So, yes, I do believe in every running back stable, you should have a big back that you force people to have to tackle over and over and over again.
I think about a couple other young backs. Javonte Williams listed at 212. I think he cut to get to 212 to run at his pro day. He ended up running 4.55. I think he plays north of 220, I would guess.
He's a physical back.
He's a tackle breaker. And then you think about Jonathan Taylor with the Indianapolis Colts, that speed power combination. And so, to me, it's fascinating. When you talk to offensive line coaches around the league, they'll talk about using formation and personnel to dictate, who they want on the field on the other side. Mm-hmm. And when you have the luxury of a big fast back, now it's like you can't be right. We want to put 13 personnel out there and bring your bigs on the field. Now you don't have anybody can run with this dude. There's not enough guys that can run with him. If he hits a crease, he's gone. And then it's like, okay, well, now we want to spread you out. You want to put all your little guys on the field. Well, have fun tackling this big joker. That's a chess piece now.
That is a chess piece. And that's why like Najee Harris and Jonathan Taylor and those guys are valued, because if you can put them on the field where they are credible threats in the passing game, where they can stay on the field in the spread formation, and you got sub packages, nickel, dime, quarter, all those little DBs on the field, and you're making them make one-on-one tackles in space, and you're testing the courage, you're testing their willingness to, hey, are they going to make business decisions, or are they going to keep playing football? That's what you want to do, and that's how you dictate the terms. And ultimately, this game is a violent game, and it's a physical game. And the team that typically wins is a team that outhits the other team. I think there are a lot of teams that are realizing the value in having that sledgehammer at running back that can do more than just a 4 minute. Like, no, he can play, he can catch the ball out the back, or he can do a bunch of different things.
Yeah, these conversations lead me to do some homework. So I'm going to go dig into next gen stats before the next episode, because I'm curious to see who's doing the most six offensive linemen sets in the league. I see it a lot with the Chargers. They've been doing a lot with Senio Calamente every week. And then who's in 13 personnel the most? I'm guessing it's the Browns, because they are in 13 a lot. But that is, again, you're dragging bigs onto the field when you do that. And I think from the Chargers standpoint, it makes sense. You drag the big guys out there because Austin Eckler is, I think I'd rather have the big guys out there than the little guys, because he's going to be a problem.
Yeah, he is going to be a problem. And the thing that you want to be able to do is you want to put the bigs out there, and you want to hammer folks. You want to wear them down. You want to control the tempo. And one of the reasons why the Patriots are beginning to do this, but the Browns, the Colts, the Ravens, the Titans, the reason why they're teams that you don't want to face is because of that element that we talked about. If they get the lead, if they happen to jump out in front by two touchdowns, good luck, because it's a steady diet of run right, run left, run right, run left. And with the Browns having two guys that are big, I think Kareem Hunt is kind of
once hefty. He comes back, man, he's a top six running back in the league. Yes. He's their second running back. I mean,
and
that's why I stand by my pick. I guess they all have COVID now, so that they're going to miss some of those runners this week. But
How about them locking up your guy, Wyatt Teller? How about that?
Is there a coincidence there? We do the Wyatt Teller XO. within 24 hours, he got paid. There you go.
Yeah, he got paid. They locked him up. And I think what you're now seeing, DJ, though, is how they're building. Because they had somebody else that was going to be a free agent that they have to – don't they have another lineman or somebody else? I knew Teller was
one. Antonio up? I don't know. I thought they
were – I don't know. It's somebody else, but I know they had to do that. But I think what you're seeing, they understand exactly who they are. And they understand what they have to have around the quarterback. And they actually, in my estimation, they have time before they have to pay Baker Mayfield. They don't have to pay him right now.
But I think can I give you one
– build up the team.
Can I give you a little food for thought on your Baker thing? Because I think we've pretty much been on the same page. Like, we'll pay him a fair number, but you don't want to go crazy. So, and we can talk about it's not really a quarterback-centric team. And maybe that's a little bit of the difference here. But remember the Kirk Cousins conversation when he left Washington? You can't pay him that. I mean, you just got to let him walk. How's Washington look at that position since he left?
I know. And even though he might
be in the wilderness. They're in the wilderness. And Kirk Cousins is a top... 8 to 14, depending on the
which one shows up every day. Whichever one shows up. But you're right, because in saying that, they need to pay him sooner rather than later. See, they need to pay him now before the costs continue to escalate. Just go ahead and bite the bullet and pay him what you have to pay him, and let everyone have outrage. Like, how could they?
But if you're Baker, do you follow the Kirk Cousins blueprint and say, no, I'm not taking that. I'll just – you franchise me for a couple of years, and then I'm going to force my way to the market if that's the case. Because we've seen it. If you're a B-level quarterback and you can get to the open market, you are going to get big-time paid.
Does he want to play that, though? Does he want to have, like, the contentious nature of those things?
Or would I don't know. I'm just saying from a negotiating standpoint, he's got some leverage. You know, we can say it's not quarterback-driven team and all this and that and the other, but you can also look at their history, and then you can look at, I think, if I'm Baker's people, I think I'd be holding up a mirror and saying, remember what it was like here, and then look at Washington.
They may have to pay him. They may have to put him in the $40 million club and pay him more than they want to.
Like, the more you look at
this. But even in that, DJ, because when the TV deals kick in, we'll use the Kirk Cousins, Derek Carr, Jimmy Garoppolo thing as a point. $27, $28 million was like, oh my God. And then
bargain.
Now that's like mid-level backup salaries money for quarterbacks. I mean, kind of. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. But the best thing Baker has going for him, if they keep chalking up wins and he's taking snaps, he gets the credit for the wins. And I know people talk about quarterback wins aren't a stat, but they have to count for something.
Yeah.
And so you keep winning games, you get very comfortable with the guy who was taking the snap. Because you were there in Baltimore, not necessarily there when they did it, but they tried that upgrade route when they had Trent Dilfer and they went for Elvis Gerbeck.
Didn't work out.
And took them a long time to get back to that level. So it is what it is.
It's very interesting. Yeah, that happened right before I got there. But that they were in the wilderness until Steve McNair came, you know?
Yeah.
We were in the wilderness. I always tell that to people when they talk about, oh, why would you take a quarterback over this guy? This guy's a better player. He's got a better grade. And I go, I'll tell you why. Because I was on a team for 4 years that had a Hall of Fame left tackle, a Hall of Fame linebacker, a Hall of Fame safety, a Pro Bowl tight end, an All-Pro running back, a potential Hall of Fame edge rusher in Suggs, a perennial Pro Bowl defensive tackle in Nada. You had Chris McAllister, perennial Pro Bowl corner. And the only ring I have on my finger is my wedding ring. So that's why the quarterback matters.
It does matter. There is some value to having the quarterback. And even if there are some deficiencies, you can work around the bulk of those efficiencies if you have enough money to be able to get the other stuff. So you have to know exactly where you are and exactly who you are. And I think it's being honest in the assessment. Hey, he's not a top five. He is this, but we can maybe make him top five-ish if we surround him with the other stuff. And so it's just understanding what they need.
Yeah, it's just fascinating because you're going to have some people say, oh, this is Jared Goff all over again. You're going to pay him and regret it. And other people are going to say, well, where is this Kirk Cousins? And you're going to let him walk and be ruined the day that you did that. So it's, to me, the Baker Mayfield contract is one of the more fascinating things I've seen since we've been doing this.
It's going to be bananas. It's going to be bananas to see what it looks like. And if I'm Baker, he has to come behind Lamar Jackson, because you want Lamar Jackson to get paid first before you go to the table.
Yeah, shoot that number up. Deal.
Yeah, because Lamar is going to shoot it up. Sky. Yeah. Like, then he's throwing the ball a little bit.
I know, Lamar. Another topic. It's another topic for another day. How well he's playing. He's playing awesome. We'll talk about that because we're doing the game Thursday night on Amazon. Again, if you haven't checked that out, check us out on Thursday night. Bucky, Joy Taylor, myself, twitch.tv/movethesticks. We have a great time. There's a chat that's open during the game. We interact with you guys, and you don't miss a play. So you see the whole game and see our analysis and reaction. We do a lot of scouting background stuff. So if you like the pod, you'll love Thursday nights. I know it's one of the most fun things we get to do, Buck.
It is a lot of fun. And this week's game is a pretty good one. You get the Ravens, the Dolphins. Should be a lot of fun.
You get the Ravens,
Dolphins.
Should be fun. Yeah, I saw you did that right Dolphins. There.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. All right. This has been fun. Appreciate you guys hanging with us. Thanks to Nabil for all the work he does producing this thing each and every week. We'll catch you next time right here on Move the Sticks.